Hi, welcome to the third episode of Jane Austentations, the podcast where we very slowly watch and review every single Jane Austen adaptation ever filmed. I'm Sasha Sienna. I'm a writer, a podcast person, and a massive fan of Jane Austen. And I have with me Jessica Law. Jess, who are you?
Hello, I'm Jessica Law, science writer, singer, dream weaver, and also occasional podcaster. And I'm new to the world of Jane Austen, and so my opinions are box fresh.
That's wonderful. Get your fresh opinions here.
Yeah, no one has ever thought them ever before in the history of humanity.
And so today we're talking about the most recent film that we watched, which is From Prada to Narda.
Or Prada versus Narda, as I kept accidentally texting you for weeks.
Yeah. Prada v Narda. From Prada to Narda is a loose adaptation of Sense and Sensibility. Sisters Mary and Nora are living the high life in Beverly Hills when their father dies very tragically. It's tragic that he dies, not that there are particularly tragic circumstances surrounding his death. Well, it was his birthday.
Yeah, he dies from dancing.
I thought he died from a heart attack. I thought that was kind of implied.
Oh, yeah, a heart attack while dancing. But the point is, this is dancing.
He dies. And then at the funeral, they find out that they have a secret brother, Gabe, who was married to an awful woman named Olivia.
And the dad's mistress names the son after the dad, which I remember you saying is quite a bold move.
I thought it was quite a power play, yeah. And they also learn that their father is bankrupt. So they have nothing, but apparently they do have this house, which is huge and in Beverly Hills, so it must be worth quite a lot. I don't really know how bankruptcy works if you also get to keep your house. Maybe they owned it outright. I'm not sure.
Well, there's liquid assets and there's...
Yeah. So they sell the house to Gabe and Olivia because Olivia has money of her own. And as in the books, Olivia is awful to them, makes living there really horrible. Like, they say at first, oh, well, you can stay with us because this is your home until you find a new place to live. And then they end up moving out rather than kind of suffer the humiliation of being moved to the basement.
Like, so the opposite of the first Mrs. Rochester.
Yeah! And then they go to stay with their mother's sister, so their Aunt Aurelia, who lives in, what's it called? East LA? Is it called, like, the Upper East Side? The Lower East Side? I don't know if that's LA or...
Is it something to do with 8 Mile? Is the 8 Mile in LA? Is, you know, with...
I have absolutely no idea.
Mr. Rapper Man, you know.
You mean Eminem?
Eminem, yes, that's it.
I don't know, but I'm sure that our listeners can tell us if they so choose to. I don't know. Actually, I don't know if listeners of this podcast are very familiar with the geography of the film 8 Mile. It's clear from now that we don't understand the different neighbourhoods of LA. We know that Beverly Hills is for rich people, and we now know that East LA is not. And they go to live there in a Latin American neighbourhood, which at first Mary seems to hate. And Nora is like...
Stoic
about it. Nora is a law student, but she quits law school so that she can find a job to support herself and Mary while Mary goes to finish college. And then...
College is university, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And then Edward Ferris, who is Olivia, the dreadful sister-in-law's brother, he turns up kind of out of nowhere with all of their stuff from their mansion in a van. And then he offers... he offers Nora a job at his law firm because he has a law firm, and then she says no and she's like, I'm gonna find a job on my own. And then he gives her the paper and she finds a job in the paper, but it turns out that was the job he was going to give her anyway, so she gets it.
18th century coincidence.
Well, it wasn't a coincidence, though, because he deliberately hands her the paper knowing full well that his is the only law job in there.
Okay, fine.
He tricks her into it. Fine. And then on the way to her day at her job, she meets some people who've been fired from their job, their cleaning jobs, because they've been accused of stealing mops or something.
I mean...
And it turns out it's all really dodgy. And then she goes to Edward and is like, I want to do all this work pro bono for these people. And he's like, we don't do that, but you're hot, so okay. And then,
I mean, even just being given a job.
Yeah.
Like, I got so enraged during that film. I don't know if you could tell in the chat, but I was like, I absolutely worked my socks off for like 7 years in not very good entry level jobs and just hadn't been able to get the kind of job that I wanted, even though I knew that I could do it for absolutely years. And then finally I've got it. And then she just gets, you know, happy
and
what?
No, I did pick up on your anger.
I was being like, does she not know the struggle I went through?
Yeah. So that's all going on, and they're doing this kind of legal battle with this company. And by legal battle, I mean a single meeting.
Naturally.
Meanwhile, Mary is not friendly with the neighbour.
Yeah.
The neighbour man, Bruno.
They certainly have some harsh words, some witty.
They trade barbs.
Forth. Yes, they do. Yeah. Like some mating garden snails. Look it up.
But she's also going to college, and she meets who I believe is introduced as like a teacher's aide.
Yeah,
I kind of hope it's a teacher's aide rather than full on a professor. It's kind of unclear, but if it's a full on professor, then it's like even less appropriate.
I think he is a teaching assistant. I think the bloke said at the start, but
yeah,
still a scoundrel.
Yes, and then she's like, oh, he's hot. And then she hits on him, and then they are dating after that. Then there is a Mexican Independence Day party at the aunt's house, and Edward shows up, and Mary invites Rodrigo, the teacher's aide, her new boyfriend, and some falling outs happen. Edward kisses Nora, and then she's really drunk as well, and then she's like, no, I'm not going to kiss you, because I have to think about my career and you're my boss. And then Mary's dancing with Rodrigo, and then Bruno's like, I don't want to dance with you. And she's like, let's have a dance now to Bruno. And Bruno's like, I don't want to dance with you. I've lost a bet or something. I mean, there's context, but basically their budding friendship is a little bit shut down or some stuff. Anyway, then Nora and Mary have a big argument, I think at that time, or maybe a little bit later than that time. And then turns out that Rodrigo is a cad and Bruno is not, and that everyone's happy at the end. So, Jess, what were your impressions of From Prada to Nada?
Oh, well, I was very pleasantly surprised. So when you told me about it, I was a little bit concerned that it might be sort of your stereotypical, obnoxiously American, like, teen movie. Like, and I can't even think of an example of one now, because I was thinking like Mean Girls, but that's actually quite good.
I have to interrupt. I have to say, I think that American high school adaptations of classic works of literature are almost universally... Okay, no, I don't. I'm not going to say they're almost universally good. But if I went on Mastermind, they would be my specialist subject. I love them.
Yeah, and I think... yeah, I would like to talk a bit later about how they really lend themselves to modern adaptations, because the same things are going on today. But yeah, I thought it was going to be sort of really obnoxious, like all-American, really saccharine, sort of annoying teen movie. But I found it a lot gentler than that. It was a little bit more sort of madcap, and it had a lot more heart. And it was really just heartwarming and quite genuine in a way. And I also thought it was filmed sort of in a very candid way, like certain bits of dialogue almost sounded like semi-improvised, but it was more naturalistic than your stereotypical teen movie. And sometimes that didn't work, but I was very pleasantly surprised.
Oh, good.
What did you think of it?
Well, I had a lot of fun watching it with you. Watching it with you over Netflix party in the chat was a lot of fun. I was surprised to hear you describe it as naturalistic, because I wouldn't have described it that way. But there were some things I really liked about it, and some things where I was just like, why would they make that baffling decision. What a choice. Why have they chosen this? What is going on? And I will be interested to see in our discussion whether that's because we genuinely have different opinions on it, like different reactions to it as a film in its own right, or if it's because I'm coming at it with these expectations of Sense and Sensibility and you're coming to it kind of on its own terms.
Yeah, I think to me it largely made sense. Apart from one point where I, again, literally didn't know where one of the main love interests had come from.
Which one was that? Was that Edward?
It was Edward, the neighbour who lived across the road.
Oh, no. I think that guy's name is Bruno.
Ah, so Bruno just seemed to be there when they arrived in their car. And I just thought, is he a cousin? Does he live with them? And then that made me feel a bit weird about them being a love interest. Because it's like, well, your cousin? Surely this is a modern adaptation. But then you helpfully explained to me that he was a neighbour from across the road. So I think me not understanding where main love interests have appeared from is going to be a running theme.
So they meet Bruno when they move in.
And he just, the Prada daughter.
So their names, where we have in the book Eleanor and Marianne, the names of these characters are Nora and Mary. And Nora's the older sister who is a law student, as she says many, many times. And Mary is the younger daughter who is a student of, it's unclear, but she at least at one point takes a literature class.
Yeah. And when she arrives in the car and then Bruno goes to fetch her bags to take them into the house and she initially thinks he's trying to steal them. But he doesn't. He takes them into the house. And then I just didn't know whether he lived in the house. Like, was he a relative or what?
There is like a second where you see him walk over from the house opposite.
Oh, well, excuse
but it's
me
like,
for
it's
blinking.
It's a blink and you'll miss it. Little bit of context, yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, I think I'll just accept it and move on.
So what did you think of the two sisters? Mary and Nora.
So I kind of liked the way that rather than some of the more stereotypical teen movies, even though they were so different, they did still seem to have a very friendly relationship and they weren't constantly at loggerheads and like Mary wasn't making fun of the sort of geeky one, Nora. And I also liked the way that Nora wasn't too geeky. Like she wore clothes that somebody might actually wear. And I don't think she had the complete sort of take your glasses off and you're suddenly beautiful transformation moment either. It was a little more subtle than that. So I liked how they didn't just do huge stereotypes. They kept it quite realistic and subtle.
Yeah, I thought they definitely captured, I would say for most of the film, I think that they definitely captured that they were sisters who loved each other. I thought that their fight at the very end, so they have this big argument at the very end that's kind of like sort of the like in the run-up to the emotional climax of the film where they're not speaking to each other until something happens that means that they come together again. Well, I don't know why I'm avoiding spoilers in this podcast in which
in
we discuss the film in depth.
Like, film.
Yeah, until we find out that Edward Ferris character, so that shock. For those of you who know the book, that that's who that is. The Edward Ferris character is getting engaged. Like when we find out about that. Interesting that you call him a scoundrel. But when we find out about the engagement, Nora is really upset. And then Mary goes into the room to comfort Nora. And then they kind of make up again. And I felt like that argument was really quite shoehorned in.
Yeah, like it wasn't in keeping with the rest of the relationship.
No, I didn't think it was in keeping with the rest of the relationship. And I'll be honest, I struggled to think of which exact part of the book they would like or what in the book they were really trying to get at with that, because I felt like, well, it doesn't really feel like it's in keeping with the rest of their relationship, and I can't think of a thing from the book that they're trying to grab in. So is it just a formulaic thing?
I felt as if it really was, because there had to be some sort of the tropes known as the third act dilemma where, like, everything seems terrible and you've fallen out with everyone you love and something terrible's happened. It's the long, dark night of the soul. And so, yeah, I definitely agree that it was for reasons of plot, as was the fire.
Yeah, I didn't really get the fire because I felt like it didn't need those things. I just felt like those things were completely unnecessary. You would have had the third act dilemma. There would have been enough tension in the third act without them if you just, instead of getting distracted with those things, honed in a little bit more on the stuff that's actually kind of fundamental to the plot.
I kind of felt that there did need to be a third act dilemma of that magnitude for a film like that, but it could have been something a little less silly.
I didn't have a problem with the silliness, but I felt like the sisterly relationship could have been deeper rather than relying on that conflict being they're having an argument.
Yeah, definitely.
And they're not speaking to each other, you know, like I felt like that was a bit lazy, I'll be honest.
You've got to have an argument in the third act dilemma. It's the law.
I feel like in what I wanted to see from their relationship, you would have been able to see their kind of conflict of values and their conflict of the way that they look at the world without them having quite such a... Do you even remember what they were arguing about?
No.
Yeah, because it just felt really quite contrived. And my guess is that, and I mean, we really did watch this film very recently, but my guess would be that it's because Mary had decided to... No, wait, it couldn't have been because Mary had decided to drop out and marry her tutor.
No, that was earlier, wasn't it? Oh.
Yeah, hang on, let me see. Oh, I found out what it was. Yes, so when Nora asks Mary if she loves Rodrigo, who's her TA, who, for people who haven't seen the film but have read the books, it's the Willoughby character. Mary says she just wants to go back to Beverly Hills and that Rodrigo can make that happen. And then Nora basically says that motivation makes you a whore.
Yes, I remember. Yes, because I remember saying, bit harsh.
Yes, I remember.
During her commentary.
Yeah, and... not sex worker positive there, Nora. But and then Mary says, well, I'd rather be a whore than a spinster. And then they don't speak to each other for a while. And that just felt really contrived. And
also, they were literally saying a plot out loud. It's the Madonna whore dichotomy,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
But it sounded like they were saying a TV tropes.
Yes,
trope
it did. It felt like loud. They were just reading out the TV tropes page. And it was something that I felt so disappointed in. And
yeah.
Mary's whole character was incredibly disappointing to me because they've taken Marianne, who is an immature, often not sensible, irresponsible young woman. You know, she's young and she's not as sensible as her sister, and she eventually has to learn to grow up, basically.
Yeah.
And they've turned her into this vapid, empty, shallow, materialistic person who, at the start of the film, seems to have no redeeming qualities. We're meant to like her simply because she's the protagonist. She goes for this guy because he's hot and rich and admits that she doesn't love him. She just wants him to buy her old house back. And I feel like that just kills so much of Marianne's character and of the dynamic between the sisters originally, which is what I think makes Sense and Sensibility such an incredible book. It just it was just baffling set of choices, like genuinely really baffling.
So I did actually think that she seemed quite like that Mary seemed quite sensible almost, and she could have done with being a little bit more frivolous and impulsive. So what was the relationship like in the original between them?
So in the original, the whole point of Sense and Sensibility, being that in Regency era, sensibility was another word for emotion, basically, is this dichotomy between Eleanor, who's the older sister and is very practical and sensible and in command of her emotions and reserved in that way that was very prized in the Regency era.
Yeah.
And Marianne, who is younger and deeply passionate and wears her heart on her sleeve. And
yeah, she didn't seem like that in the
film. I didn't see any passion from her.
Yeah, she just seemed a little bit superficial,
yes,
and materialistic.
Absolutely superficial. Like when Marianne and Willoughby first meet in the books, they instantly connect on a really deep level. Well, you know, as deep as you can be in the first like 5 minute meeting, and then you head off. But like they instantly connect because they have so much in common.
Yeah.
And they genuinely do fall really deeply in love because they have so much in common and they get on so, so well. and they both are super into like poetry and romantic art and all this stuff, and they have all like all the same tastes, and they're constantly reading poetry to each other in this really like we love this art kind of a way.
Yeah. And I think, well, they do a bit of that in the film, but it's really quite glanced over.
It's so glanced over that my interpretation of it was that Mary wasn't into literature at all, is only going to college because she's a certain age, and when you have a certain amount of money, that's what you do when you're that age.
Yeah.
And then she goes for a TA and kind of gets into poetry to impress him. Or it's entirely possible she's not really that into poetry. She's just saying she is. Like, it's... and then she says later, no, I don't love him, I just want him to buy our house.
Yeah, that's a very, very bizarre choice. Yeah. I'm not sure why they might have done that.
Why would you choose to make your character so much emptier? Why would you choose to take away that much depth?
If anything, it would have served the film and the plot better if you'd have had that difference between them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why I was saying they seem to get on better and like it was quite subtle and it wasn't so...
Oh, well, I think they do get on, and I really like that relationship with them. You know, they're very, very different, and they argue a fair amount, but because they have kind of different ways of looking at the world and different values, but they are also best friends. Like they love each other very deeply. And I did feel like they did in this film. I think you got that sense, at least.
Yeah. There was a bit where she did seem to like the poetry. I think it was a poem by Lorca or something like that. And it was where she was saying, I'm falling in love with this culture. Because she goes from being, like, thinking of herself as American to thinking of herself as Mexican and knowing, you know, finding out way more about traditional Mexican culture and her roots. And I think you kind of did get that sense of discovery and like and the passion in that bit of it.
Definitely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I did think that was the one thing about Mary's character arc that I genuinely really liked.
Yeah, it gave her more heart. And it served the... Because the film almost... From what you are saying, it seems like the film almost chose less to focus on the relationship between these two very different sisters and instead focus on the sort of riches to rags situation.
Yeah, which is also the other side of the film. And it is very much what a lot of modern adaptations pick up on, because it's kind of... I guess if you're pitching it to producers... That's the easy sell, right? It's not like, oh, it's a story about two sisters and how one of them learns to be more like the other. It's like, it's a riches to rags story.
And you do actually have something visual to show
when
it's a riches to rags story. Yeah. Like, there's something to literally, like, visually film.
Yeah.
Which probably appealing to the director.
I thought that that was really... there was ups and downs in it, I'd say, but I thought that the introduction of the element of Mexican culture that they can reconnect with was really nice. It really definitely added more depth for me to that side of it.
Although, I think that bit worked. Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, I think that bit really worked. And I was actually reading an article earlier this week. I can't remember who the author is, but the article was called White People Have No Culture. And it was basically about how the fact that a lot of sort of white American culture and probably white middle-class British culture is based on only sort of consumerism and capitalism and showing off to your friends. And there's not much sort of heart and family and warmth in it. So white culture often just steals from other cultures and even exploits them, because it's almost like there's a black hole at the centre. It doesn't have its own culture anymore. Mm. Just has this culture of sort of exploitation and colonialism. And I found that was true of the film, because it's like at the start, yes, they really love their dad and the dad's quite into Mexican culture, but the sisters' lives are very much based on this sort of capitalism, consumerism. And then when they go to the sort of less wealthy house of their relatives, they then learn that there's more to life.
Yeah, I think certainly there was a really nice element of them connecting with a community, definitely. Yeah. Although I was a little bit like, your dad was so into Mexican culture, why didn't you notice it when you were living with him?
Yeah. Also, can I just say, I did not understand how that house was supposed to be poor. Because I mean,
oh my goodness, I know. Yeah. They turned up. It's like, whoa, this is like a 4-bed detached house in the city? What?
Like they move from one mansion to another mansion. And maybe American listeners can help me out with this, but an English person would give their right hand to live in...
I would love to live somewhere with that much space.
I don't understand how that was meant to be poor.
No.
And, you know, it seemed quite pleasant, you know?
And I never know.
It seemed friendly.
Yeah, I never know with these, like, when you're watching things that are made in America and they have these huge houses, I never know if it's because genuinely in America they have so much more space that that is normal. And, like, that's a crowded house to them. Or if it's that the people making these films have never been poor and have absolutely no hint of context or scale of how people actually live. I don't know. I can't tell.
They just can't, like, they can't even envision living in a house that isn't a huge, detached, several floors mansion.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Have they ever, like, what would they think of a terraced two up, two down?
Yeah, they, I don't know. They might start shrinking to, I don't know. Like, I'm thinking of goldfish, but in the opposite, I've gone mad. But yeah, they would be confused. But yeah, maybe some American listeners can...
can tell us, like, is that how you all live? Really?
What the heck's going on? I mean, and I suppose you can have...
It was massive!
Oh my god, yeah! And all those flowers! Oh, I have a fun fact.
Yeah, go on.
I have a fun fact about the Bird of Paradise flower.
Oh yeah.
Because Bruno, sort of throughout the film, there's this motif of Bruno loving these Bird of Paradise flowers. They represent Mexico and they represent, like, his romance with Mary. So I have a fun fact about them. So if you look at them, basically we've been looking at them the wrong way round all the time. So if you look at the flower, most people see it as a bird's head with a big, long beak.
Hang on, I'm just getting an image up.
Yeah, I might do that as well so that I don't start talking nonsense.
I've got a picture.
Yeah, so say you've just got one.
Yeah, I've got one.
You might think that it's a big bird's head with a pom-pom on top of it. But that's not what the Bird of Paradise is. The Bird of Paradise is the little blue shoot that's above the big triangly bit. And then the pom-pom bit, that's its wings and tail.
The pom-pom bit is its wings and tail?
Yeah, the big orange pom-pom is its wings and tail. And then if you look between
Oh my goodness!
Yeah!
Oh, I see it now!
Yeah, so it's like a magic eye poster, isn't it?
Oh wow, yeah.
So, like, everybody thinks that it's meant to be the head, but it's the whole bird is on there if you look at it properly.
I see it now.
Look it up. I don't know if I've explained it well enough, but look it up. Like, it's the whole bird.
Ah.
So that's my factoid of the day.
Good factoid. Thank you for introducing bird facts.
Thanks. I've completely derailed the entire conversation now. I can't remember where we were.
I think that we were saying about the house being lovely. And when they have that Mexican Independence Day party... And okay, yes, part of the plot is that Bruno's made it look really nice, but it looks really fucking nice.
It's so nice, and they just seem to be having much of a warmer and more loving, joyous time than the fancy engagement party that the rich house later on. Like, it just seems more community based and closer. And
I don't know why.
And
we're,
I think that's. I don't know. I just think that is kind of true of poorer communities. A lot of the time, they're not just existing in their separate islands like richer ones are. Yeah. They join together more.
Yeah, there was definitely a big difference between that party and the party for Edward's engagement. So yeah, let's talk about Edward Ferris.
Ah yes. So Edward Ferris is the scoundrel character.
Not at all as intention, I don't think so. So obviously in every Austin story, I think it's obvious that there is one man who is a dirtbag. There's a fuckboy in every Austin.
Well, when I was watching the film, I was thinking, I haven't read the book, but I can tell that there are the bones of an Austin novel, because there's a scoundrel. There's a man who starts out a bit rude and standoffish, but then they fall in love. There's sort of these thing about wealth, sort of riches to rag. And also the sort of pervasive idea that being rich isn't all that. Like, I think Jane Austen was maybe trying to reassure herself in her impoverished state that, you know, life can be more fun when you're not super rich. But I could definitely see it was based on a Jane Austen novel. But yes, the scoundrel figure in the story.
Yeah, I'm really sure that the film from Prada to Nada wants us to think that Edward Ferris is the good guy, the wholesome good guy. Like, that's who Edward Ferris is in the original
work. So he's the one who offered Nora a job as a way of flirting with
her. Yeah, so he is basically, here's how we meet Edward Ferris. He is the brother of their awful sister-in-law.
Who wore a leopard print dress to a funeral.
Yeah, I thought that was a very strong look.
I remember saying in our chat, like, a leopard print dress to a funeral, that costume isn't even accurate for nowadays. Like, and there was a couple of other moments, but maybe we'll get to those. But yeah. So my costume hat is still on.
So we meet him, and then he and Nora meet at the door and have some sort of argument about whether or not weed should be legal.
Oh yeah, that's such a strange meet cute.
It's a bizarre meet cute. And then Mary and Nora move out, basically, at the whole, like, Edward has been given Mary's room to stay in, and they're being moved to the basement. And Ferris, they meet him. He turns up out of the blue to what we're supposed to believe is a small house, but we've already covered that, with an entire huge moving truck full of stuff, including a painting.
And what would you do with that? Like, your house is already full of its own stuff.
And
like,
some
of this
stuff,
what use is that going
to
serve
you? Some of that
you?
Stuff is too big to get through the door of this new house.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of like, oh, this is so nice of you. Like, you know what you should have done, mate? You should have rented a storage facility.
Yeah.
Not turned up to this house. Didn't even call ahead.
Yeah, like, can you imagine the logistical nightmare if someone
so
did that to
inconsiderate.
You? Yeah. Oh, do you know what a really good prank is? So, is to order a skip for outside somebody's house, because you don't pay to order the skip, you pay to make the skip go away. You pay to get it connected.
I don't know if that's a prank so much as just fraud, Jess.
Well, no, because you can ring them up and ask them to deposit a skip outside someone's house. And then what'll happen, it'll look unsightly, it'll fill up their parking space, and people will start dumping their stuff in the skip, and it'll cause this huge problem. And then the people in the house will have to pay to get it removed. So it's like the ultimate inconvenience. And this is almost what's happening here. It's like almost the same prank.
But meant to be a nice thing. So he turns
up. I'm such a bad influence.
You are a terrible influence, but a joy to be influenced by. Yeah, and then when he turns up, when he's there, he offers her a job. Like, he has no idea what her qualifications are or whether she'd be good at this job. He offers her a job in his law firm, which, by the way, is a very sought-after opportunity. But no, other people don't get a fair shot at this because he wants to go out with Nora, so she gets the job. She declines.
This is why people get jobs. I've realised now, people get jobs because, like, an extended family member fancies them. Like, this is why I just haven't been able to get until
because
now,
none of your
I'm
relatives
now, just
want to date you.
Yeah, none of my extended non-blood relatives wanted to date me. This must be how people get jobs. I've been doing it wrong for this whole time.
Well, Nora says that she wants to get a job on her own, which is admirable. And then Edward basically kind of tricks her into applying for the job he was going to give her anyway so that he can just give it to her still, which is scumbag behaviour. And when she gets there, people are shady to her, kind of understandably.
Yeah, they're like, they all peer out of their cubicles to get a good look.
And then, so she comes into his office saying, like, I'm an intern, but I want you to do pro bono work, which you have stated that you don't do, which seems dickish enough in itself, to help these people that I've met. And Ed was like, yes, okay, I haven't done pro bono work before, but now that you, a hot girl in my family, want me to, I will.
Really great motivations there for the public good.
Yeah, just to be very clear again, this is not a blood relative, this isn't a cousin situation. He is the brother of an in-law. And then later, he kisses her while she is drunk. And then when she says no, she doesn't want to kiss him because she cares about her career, he promotes her without telling her. She just comes to work one day and her computer's off. And she's like, what's going on? And the receptionist tells her, you've moved to the 30th floor, but in a way that makes it clear that she thinks it's because she's dating her boss. Because it absolutely looks like she's dating her boss. And then she quits her job.
Out of moral indignantness. Although, I must say, even after all that had happened, I might not quit my job. Because jobs are precious, and you don't just get handed to you on a plate by people who... But you have to sweat in a living hell for 7 years dealing with the general public before you can get to do anything that you enjoy.
Yeah, I will say, like, I think that in this riches to rags story, I did not get the impression that the people making the film understood what poverty actually is at all.
And they just don't understand life. Like, they don't seem to understand
life. They think that being poor means living in a slightly shabby house, like living in a house that's still big, still functional, but looks a bit dilapidated, like has old wallpaper, you know?
And I don't know, though, because I think there are ways of living in a physically large... I think we in Britain associate physically large spaces with wealth, but... I think there are certainly ways that you can be disadvantaged and still
that's
live
absolutely
in a
fair,
physically
but it's
large
certainly
house.
Not. I'm going to quit my job. Like, I'm supporting me and my sister in college, and I'm about to quit my job rather than take a promotion because I don't want it to look bad in front of my colleagues. Like that just was a real like. This seems superficial at best. Like.
It's, yeah, absolutely outrageous behaviour.
And then after that, he announces his engagement real fucking quick. So it's like, you were clearly dating this person that you're engaged to now. Either that or you've just bafflingly decided to get married on a whim to someone who I'm pretty sure has one line in the entire film.
Is she the friend of the...
Yeah, she's the sister-in-law's friend.
And she's just like, oh, maybe you shouldn't stand beneath that beam that's going to fall.
And then that's
head.
The only word she says. Line. And then he meets Nora at the engagement party. They have some big scene. And then later he turns up with another truck full of stuff, being like, I bought you a house.
So his two ways of flirting with this woman have been to give her a job and to buy her a house.
Yeah, it's dodgy as hell.
I think he needs to work on his seduction technique because that's just putting too much pressure on a person. Like, that's coming on way too strong.
Yeah, 100%, way too strong. And you know that she is in a difficult economic position. You know that you are, like, you have a privilege here and you are using her situation to try and get her to go out with you. And you are fucking lucky that she's in love with you anyway.
And he's meant to be the good guy.
And I hate this version of Edward Ferrars, or Edward Ferrars as the original one is. The difference is that the original's surname is Ferrars, A-R-S at the end, and this one is Ferris, as in Ferris Wheel or Ferris Bueller. Not sure why they made the change.
Ferrars. That's quite a common British
name. Maybe they wanted to make it sound
less, that's
why British. But he's rubbish. He sucks.
He's a silly Billy.
Harsh words.
He's not a sensible Bensible at all.
Indeed, not a sensible Bensible.
And then the one who was meant to be the scoundrel seems relatively innocuous in comparison.
What, Rodrigo?
Yeah.
Rodrigo, who went out with his student and then turned out to be already married.
Oh, yeah, I suppose that maybe he was just had less screen time.
Yeah, I think maybe he just had less screen time. And I think because, by comparison, we're meant to think of him as a scumbag.
Yeah, we're judging him by different standards.
It's like, well, we expect you to be a scumbag, Rodrigo. We had no expectations for you.
Yeah, like the minute he said, oh, I've got to go away all of a sudden. Yeah. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is the scoundrel trope.
I've heard that one before.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yes, I got that impression as well. I was aghast.
What did you think of Bruno?
Oh, I thought Bruno was really nice. Like, yes, they did sort of trade some harsh words, but he seemed really caring and he seemed to invest a lot of his own time and energy in making them feel welcome.
Yes.
Like, while not really expecting too much in return.
Yes, I thought that was nice. He clearly didn't expect anything from them except, like, basic manners. And I think that was the point of tension, was that he wasn't getting, like, basic politeness from Mary.
Basic manners. But, yeah, I just thought that he was definitely the most sympathetic character in the whole thing and was...
Oh, I agree.
At the end, when you find out his job is literally teaching children art.
Yes, and he's like doing that mural on the back, and it's I agree. He's
also
the most likable.
Incidentally, when Mary just enters her house somehow, even though she has a broken leg in a cast, which I think she must use as like a battering ram to get through the door, but like she just—I think it must be a trope of Jane Austen adaptations, people just entering others' homes.
Unannounced.
Because that happened in Pride and Prejudice as well. Just went into someone's house. But yeah, she bursts through and then she sees him teaching the kids to paint, and it's just this nice moment where it's like, oh, he's a goodie.
Yeah, he was nice. I really liked him.
Yeah, and I think so far, and I'm saying this as somebody who likes period costume a great deal, I think so far he is the most dashing of all of the male love interests that I've seen.
Yeah, I'd agree. Adaptation. If I had to pick one to go out with it, like, yeah, I would pick
Bruno. Definitely choose him.
Yeah, definitely.
But but handsome and caring, you know, what's not to like?
Artistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's always important. But maybe I'll watch a film which will change my mind.
I mean, there are a lot more to get through, but I think he's a solid choice up there with the best.
Yeah.
I think
I won't fix a
car as well, so saves you money on mechanics.
Yeah,
helps his neighbours. What's not to like?
Knows about the Bird of Paradise flower.
Yeah,
I mean, I hope he knows that it's that way round.
You could trade Bird of Paradise facts.
Yeah,
pretty solid choice.
Good.
And I did like their relationship, that like they started out disliking each other and it was largely because of kind of Mary's prejudices, and then as she kind of opened her eyes,
so did he.
Yeah, and well, she became more of an option for him, I guess, is the other thing.
Yeah, when she actually started being civil.
What did you think about the side characters in this one?
I thought that they were much, much blander than your conventional period drama adaptation. They were just really quite forgettable. The only one that I can really remember in any great detail is the stepmother.
The sister-in-law.
Stepmother? The sister-in-law, sorry. Olivia. And that's only because she had the most excellent costumes. I mean, she wore a leopard print dress to a funeral, but it was pretty cool. And then she wears this wonderful gold lamé dress at the fancy cocktail party.
Oh, that was a brilliant outfit. I would love a crack at her wardrobe.
Yeah. But apart from that, the central characters I did find had quite a lot of depth and warmth, but they weren't the magical, witty, infuriating, idiosyncratic, eccentric characters that there are usually. And I think I did notice the lack.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree. I think that the Olivia character, the sister-in-law, was a little bit too pantomimey.
Yeah, she could have been more obnoxious, but more subtly.
Yeah, but I felt like she was kind of making up for a lack elsewhere. I thought that the aunt, Aurelia, was a very likeable character, and she had some good moments, like when she sells Mary's car
Oh yeah.
And then
she certainly and
then she also
there.
Sells the purse as well.
Oh yeah. That's a really nice touch. Yeah. But like there could be more of that.
Yeah.
Yes, I found she was really nice as well, but we just didn't see enough of her.
No, I thought we didn't see enough of her. I would have liked to have seen more. Yeah. Lucy, the character that Edward Ferris was engaged to, was like nothing. Like
yeah.
The actress in that plays Lucy Steele is in How to Get Away with Murder, and I think she's good there. But you'd never know because she's got nothing to work with.
And usually I get the impression that in Jane Austen novels, one of the most emotionally heart-rending things about them is what the romantic rival is like. Like, that's a big part of, from what I can tell, like, what your rival is like is a big part of the tension and the worry and the agonising as it is in life. And to just make the romantic rival just a skittle that can be knocked over, it was a missed move.
Oh, absolutely. There. Yeah, I think that's really insightful.
A missed trick.
I think you'll be much more pleased with other versions of that character. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think that was a real shame. The brother, quite likeable.
Yeah, sort of an everyman character.
Yeah. I didn't really understand the whole thing with, like, why he hadn't got his letters. Was his mum supposed to have sent them back? So the, you know, because the dad had written him letters. So it turns out that the dad wasn't, like, a deadbeat dad who'd just abandoned him and never tried to get in touch. Yeah. The dad had written him letters, but they'd always got returned. It turned out in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, that was a bit of a throwaway.
Yeah. I thought that... One thing that I thought that they did quite well as the adaptation was the scene where Marianne, in the original, the scene where Marianne gets really sick is because she's gone out for a walk in the rain while sad.
Oh no!
Yeah.
That's practically deadly in the Regency era.
Yeah, so in this one, she goes out for a drive in the rain while sad and ends up in a car crash, which, like, no, that one's actually a lot more dangerous. I see where you're going with that one.
Yeah, that's actually better because, it's a very difficult, what with modern medicine, for going out in the rain being sad to kill you. Mm. And also going out in the car being sad. How is that going to make you ill? So, the crash was a good...
I thought that was quite well done. And I think we've already talked about the inclusion of their kind of reconnecting with Mexican culture or connecting for the first time with Mexican culture, which I thought really added a lot of heart that was really missing from other aspects of the adaptation.
Yes, I thought so too.
And like obviously I'm a white person living in Britain. I don't know anything about Mexican American culture apart from what I see from media and books that I read and stuff like that. Like, I can't speak to how accurate a portrayal it was or how respectful a portrayal it was. And I would be interested to hear from listeners if you are Mexican-American or know more about it than me. I'd be interested to hear what you thought of that portrayal. But I really thought that was the only likable thing about Mary's character. Was seeing her learn more about it.
Definitely. Yeah, and I should have said that, again, it's just what I've seen in the media, but when I went on my huge rant earlier. but I agree with you.
Yeah. Should we do our scoring? I think we've been talking for about an hour.
Yes. Let's do our scoring.
So we have previously done a lot more discussion about the scoring, but we found we were having to shut down a load of the earlier general chat to be like, oh no, let's wait till we're doing the scoring. And now we've decided we can't be bothered with any of that. We're just going to say what we want in the chat bit and then give scores real quick. So,
although I might have to go off on a mild diversion, even though I'm the one who came up with this new structure, because I'm a terrible person.
Well, fair enough though. Let's see on our whole category. We have got, first of all, the likability of the leading lady, which for this one is going to be a joint score. They're scored as a team, graded as a group.
So I thought they were both likeable, but it was let down by the sort of complete superficiality of Mary. But I did like how Nora wasn't your conventional geek. It was a bit more subtle than that. In fact, did she actually have a transformation moment when she put on her sister's dress? Like, did she take her glasses off? I can't remember.
I don't remember if she took her glasses off. She She definitely put on a dress.
Yeah, it was a bit more subtle than your usual transformation. It was more subtle.
The thing is, I thought that like the actress who plays Nora and how they kind of style her is just beautiful throughout already. And I felt like the film acknowledged that she was really hot already.
Yeah, they didn't make her ugly. Although there was another moment where I said, that's inaccurate even for nowadays, which is where Nora originally walks into the room in this sort of quite frumpy smart dress and some completely flat pumps to go to a fancy engagement party. And I just thought that was too stereotypical, that was too unrealistic. Like, you wouldn't wear them that flat with that dress, calf-length dress, like...
I would wear flat pumps to a fancy party. I hate wearing heels.
Oh, I would as well and have, but I wouldn't wear them with that plain navy
dress. But I don't think
dress,
it's fair to say that it wouldn't happen. I have seen people wear stuff like that before.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, so I think jointly there were bits where they were let down, but they were more subtle than the pantomime proportions that they could have been. I might give them a 5?
Okay. What, out of 5?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're doing it out
of
5,
aren't we? Wait, do we do it out of
5?
Right? No, we do do it out of 10. You're right. We do it out of 10. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to give them a 5 because I would have liked to see more.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would give them a 5 as well because I didn't really find either of them particularly likable. Actually, I might give them a 4. I liked Mary a lot better by the end because obviously she gets more likeable, but certainly for the first half of the film, there's just nothing to like about her. And Nora is more likeable, but I found her to be really contrived. Like, she's always going on about how she's a law student.
Oh, yeah. Like, who would actually say that?
And
that?
It's like,
I mean, I do know
people who do say stuff like that, and they're awful. They're very obnoxious. And she's going around handing out legal advice, opening up a free legal clinic. And if you are a law student, surely you should know that you are not qualified to give legal advice. You are not qualified to open up a legal clinic. You need to finish school before you can give legal advice. So I found her a bit obnoxious in that way because I guess I'm kind of linking her to other people who are constantly going on about how they're like, well, I'm studying this or something. It's like, but you're not actually qualified for it yet. So maybe don't keep going on about it. And didn't feel like there was that much else to her character. I did
I agree.
There were a few moments where I felt like something more really came through. Like, I did really like the bit where she first meets Edward and she's talking about why weed should be legalized. That made her seem like she had a lot more to her, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'll give them a 5 also.
Okay.
So 10 out of 20 on that front for likability.
Righty-ho.
Of leading ladies. Okay, how sexy did you think the leading men were? Now,
well,
I think we have to... Okay, so Sense and Sensibility is a tough one because you've got 3 potential options. Like with Pride and Prejudice, we talk about Darcy, but we do kind of consider Willoughby a little bit, but we mostly talk about Darcy, whereas here you've got 2 men they actually end up with. So your romantic leads, you've got 2 of them. And then you
from the
also
sublime
got Rodrigo
to the
as well.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame because Bruno is going to be the high scorer for
far. Yeah.
Mm.
Whereas Edward is just bleh.
A scoundrel. So I think in that case I'm going to go with a 7 because I probably would have given Bruno a 10 because Bruno is someone who I could imagine being a suitor. Whereas, what's his name?
Edward.
I've forgotten his name. Edward.
Yeah.
It's just... The fact that he's presented as a hero and yet just blatantly isn't. So I'm going to have a 7 because that's an average between the two because I probably would have given him a 5.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah,
a 4. I would have given him a 4. Yeah, I would have given him a 4 and Bruno a 10. So the average between that is a 7.
Okay, that's a really good way to do it. Yeah, I think I would have given Bruno a 10 as well because I can't find fault with Bruno. He's a delight. With a pure heart, he's compassionate,
but he's also got a bit of sass.
He's also got a bit of sass, and he's hot as well.
Stands up for himself.
Yeah,
not a pushover.
No faults to find with Bruno. What a perfect man. But Edward sucks, and he's got very bad hair. as well.
So bad. It's just flat.
And you never see him in anything other than a poor suit. Like a really rubbishy, nothingy suit that just does nothing for him. So I think I would have given Edward a 3.
Oh, okay.
I just really don't like this version of Edward.
Ever score from you.
He makes me mad, honestly. It makes me so angry what they've done with him. So what would be the kind of middling there?
The
6.5?
Yeah.
So we're going 13.5 on that one out of 20. Yeah. It's a shame that he's let the whole side down. Rodrigo, as a scumbag, he's fine.
He's let us down, he's let the film down, and he's let the novel down.
Yeah.
He should be very ashamed of himself.
And most importantly, he's let Bruno down.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about the sharpness and the funniness of the side characters?
I'm not going to give them a 0. I'm going to give them a 1, because they were barely there.
They were barely there. I think
The one is for the aunt who very enterprisingly sold the car and then the bag that was in the car.
I liked the aunt quite a lot. I really liked the scene where they were like sizing up Rodrigo. I thought that was very cute.
Yeah.
And I thought that the Olivia character was pantomime-ish, but I enjoyed her. And I thought everyone else added little. I'm going to give a 3. So
okay.
I think that's a
4,
4 out of 20. And what about the Austen Leigh vibes? Did you think that there was an Austen Leigh vibe to this film?
Weirdly enough, I did think the Austen Leigh vibe was quite high. Like, as I mentioned before, I could see the bones of an Austen novel. I could see the themes. And I also think that one of the reasons that, because there's Clueless is an adaptation of Emma, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And I think one of the reasons that Jane Austen novels lend themselves to modern, teenaged, like, chick flicks is that the same things are happening to teenagers now, or young women, like eligible bachelors, people treating them, like, horribly, or like, scandal and intrigue, and like it's just this taps into the same tumultuous emotions that you're feeling at that time in your life. That's never going to change, and that's always going to be the case throughout history. And I think the audiences are probably the same as well. Like, she was writing to young women mainly and men, but like that's what the audiences are for those films. So yes, same themes, same audiences. So I think I'm going to give the Austen Leigh vibe as an unexpectedly high 6.
Okay. I would agree that there are some of the bones of an Austen story here. However, the strengths of this film are not the things that I think are the Austen Leigh story.
Ah, okay. Bit too freestanding.
Yeah, I think for me they... The bits of Sense and Sensibility, the original work, that are really strong, I think are really let down by this film.
Yeah.
And I think that its saving graces are, well, Bruno, as we've discussed at length, and this whole journey with Mexican-American culture that, I want to say both sisters, but mostly Mary, but a little bit Nora. You see Nora have subtler moments as well, like while she's living in the aunt's house, and that's nice too.
Yeah, she wears a traditional Mexican outfit, which she really loves, to the party.
Yeah. Or I don't think it's traditional, but it's like the outfit that she wears to the party is kind of more reminiscent of that style.
Yeah.
And that's really nice. And Mary, but it's Mary's journey, really. And that's the best thing about Mary's character, and is actually Mary's story for sure. I really liked that. I wouldn't call it Austen Leigh vibes.
Yeah.
And that is not, I do want to make it really explicit here, because it is a point of debate in quotation marks in general Austen circles. What I'm saying here is not that having diversity in an Austen film is not an Austen Leigh vibe. I am not saying
not at all.
That it's not Austen Leigh to have people of colour in an Austen adaptation. And I'm not saying that it's not Austen Leigh to have those stories set in cultures that are not Regency England.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. And I think we might come across a character of colour that was in a Jane Austen novel, arguably, later on at some point.
We very much will be, yeah. And there are other adaptations that do look at Austen stories in the context of cultures that are not that that Regency England culture. And they do it well, for sure, I think. What I'm saying here is that what I thought the strength of this film was this reconnecting with a heritage or reconnecting with a different way of life. And
yes, yeah, so it was almost like it was a different topic to the original book. Just
and I don't think that that is a theme that Austen really spent any time on.
Yeah, I agree with you. I know what you mean.
She focused on other things, and those are other things that can be found within that context. And that context of reconnecting with the heritage was a really nice addition here. But the actual Austen Leigh themes were really weak. So that's why I'm giving it a low score.
Okay.
Yeah, if you're gonna say that something can't have an Austen Leigh vibe because it's not got just full of white people, then you can stop listening to this podcast, please.
Yeah, this should go and take a long walk off a short pier.
Yeah, basically I'm saying that because I'm about to give this a really low score and I don't want anybody to take that as a support for a really horrible argument. So I'm going to give this one, I think, a 3.
Okay, fair enough. I would say it doesn't have the Peter Rabbit situation, though. I've come up with an idea about films in my head, yeah, where it's like, there are some films where you think, why did they even bother making this an adaptation of something? It's so different that you could have just written a new film from scratch. And with Peter Rabbit, like, with the CGI film of it, I mean, James Corden does as good a job as he possibly can, but it's just, what, no, it's just not Peter Rabbit. It's just a completely new plot with some rabbits in for some reason. And like, and they did that with a lesser known children's novel called Bottersnikes and Gumballs.
Wow.
Which is set in, it's so amazing. It's trippy, it's weird. It's set in the Australian outback and there are these two warring factions of imaginary creature. There's the Bottersnike who lives in a dump, a literal dump, and eats mattress foam. And its nose is the shape of a cheese grater, and there's one that can dream things that become real. And then the Gumballs are these little squashy, like, friendly creatures that can morph into different shapes, and they're constantly warring. It's like good against evil. And then in the adaptation, it's just this obnoxious cartoon where they're all shouting, and the Gumballs aren't gentle, they're just bolshy and obnoxious, and no wonder the Buttersnikes want to quarrel with them. And it's just, like, why bother?
Mm.
To make an adaptation of something at all, if it's so different that you might as well just write a new film. So that complete ridiculous rant, I don't think it was one of those, but I'd agree. Saying, definitely some holes.
Yeah, I'd agree that it is not a Peter Rabbit film, which I love as a term and is actually a really useful way of, like, it's a really useful phrase to have.
You heard it here first.
Yes, yeah, it's not a Peter Rabbit. It's definitely an Austen adaptation, but it's not. It's just not got that Austen Leigh vibes for those reasons.
Yeah. What categories have we got left?
Enjoyability. How much fun did you have watching this film?
I did enjoy it. I found it was maybe a slightly bland in places, but it was a relaxing, warm-hearted, and much quirkier and more subtle than in your face, full-on chick flick. I would give it a 7.
I also had a lot of fun with this. I have to say, and we've been very upfront, like, our reviews are our personal subjective opinions, and I'm going to be upfront and say I have no idea whether I'd have enjoyed this film nearly as much if I hadn't been watching it while chatting with you on Netflix Party.
Aww.
But that is how I watched it, and so I did have a lot of fun. And I feel like if I watched it again, that would still be my impression of it, and I'd still be having fun. But I agree, it was a really warm-hearted film, and was actually, like, the day that I watched it, just what I needed as well.
Oh, me too.
I'm also going to give it a 7, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So that makes 14 out of 20. So its final score is...
Oh, wait, shall I do a drum roll?
Oh, yes, could you? And that'll give me time to actually, like...
Okay, So yeah. You say the score is?
Score is 50.5%. 50.5%.
Out of 100?
Yeah, 50.5.
Oh, is that an all-time low?
It's by far an all-time low, but it is only number 3. My gosh. And we did give the first two that we did quite high scores, to be fair. I think that they're both quite strong show.
And we've still got a long way to go up and down.
We have got a long way to go up and down, yeah, for sure. So, yeah, 50.5 from Prada to Nada. I hope that people who've said that we are giving too high a score to all of our films will be sated by that lower offering.
Yeah, need not be concerned. Oh, and we've still got our bonus scores.
And we've still got our bonus scores to discuss, which don't contribute to the final percentage score, for the simple reason that when I started my blog, I was like, those are the 5 things that I think I want when I'm sitting down to watch an Austen adaptation. They are by no means the only important things, and they are by no means all important things for everybody, but those are the things that I personally want. So now we have to also rate sexiness of leading ladies, likability of leading men, and modern sensibility, like how appropriate it is to modern sensibilities, and the other one is faithfulness to the book. So, shall we start with sexiness of leading ladies?
Oh my god,
I'm so sorry.
What?
I couldn't remember the actresses' names, so I looked them up on IMDb, and the woman who plays Mary was also the kid from Spy Kids.
Good. What?
Have you not seen Spy Kids? You've never seen Spy Kids?
Well, no. I grew up under a rock, learning about
wood mice. Yeah, that's true. You did. Yeah.
Like my first album was Halt the Planet.
What an amazing bit of Jess lore. If you don't want to watch the film but you do want to picture the actress, it's Carmen Cortez from Spy Kids.
You go first.
Okay, I wasn't attracted to Mary at all, and now I'm wondering if it's because subconsciously I thought of her as Carmen Cortez from Spy Kids. But I thought that Nora was very hot, so I'm struggling to give a mixed score there.
It's a load of averages, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I'll give an average, and I guess I'll say that I tell you what, like, I'd probably have given pretty much the same score that I'd have given for the men's sexiness. Like, I think we've got one high scorer, one low scorer. I wouldn't say that Nora reaches the heights of Bruno, but I also wouldn't say that Mary reaches the lows of Edward.
Yeah.
So I'll give another 6.5.
Okay. So I thought they were presented very well, but their personalities weren't as vibrant as they could have been. So I'm going to go with a 6.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's fair. What about likability of the leading men? I really feel like we covered a lot of this.
Yeah,
we were
talking
about how sexy
they
were. I think we'll go with the same. Yeah, I would definitely be going with the same.
Because a lot of their sexiness was based on their likability in this film.
Yeah. So then we've got modern sensibilities.
So I found it was very in keeping with modern sensibilities. Well, no, but there were bits. So the overall journey was very in keeping of modern sensibilities. You know, it wasn't this snobbish message that only the rich people are good. It had this really nice message that multiculturalism and community is really important. And that might not be the modern sensibility that rules the world at the moment, but I certainly think it should be. On the other hand, there was the man who offered her a job because he fancied her. What's his name?
Edward.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, there was
a bland
Edward.
Name for a bland man.
Yes. And then there were also a couple of moments where the script was a bit...
Yikes.
Like when she called her sister a whore.
Yeah.
So I think maybe it's almost exactly in the middle. No, I'm going to give it a 6.
Okay. Yeah, I think, that bit with the, like, you're basically a whore. Well, I'd better be that than a spinster. It's like, your sister's, what, 22? Like,
yeah. It's almost as if they're using the language of the novel. I'm not
well, they would
sure
never
the
have,
language of use.
They were, yeah. That language would never have been in the novel.
Oh, I mean sort of the language of the time. It's almost like it was a really obvious nod to the language of the time.
It's like they want to be setting up this false dichotomy, yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think that the fact that we're supposed to think that Edward Ferris is a good dude was blah. But I really liked that they explored this aspect of, like, contemporary American life. As I, a British person, can tell, that, like, that is a part of the modern American immigrant experience. And I thought that it was really nice that they chose to focus on that. I would have preferred that they had done better at some of the other stuff.
Yeah. But you can have both.
But yeah, you can have both. It does not need to be an either or. So yeah, I would say probably a 7.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the next one?
And the last one is faithfulness to the book, which I appreciate is probably on me. It's not faithful to the book. It's not faithful to the book at all. It's just not. 2.
2
out of 10. Yeah, it's really not faithful to the book.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's not, like, for me, that doesn't really matter. It can be, you know, you can have an adaptation that takes a lot of the heart and a lot of the themes and a lot of the character and a lot of the structure and like, reworks it completely and can make a great Austen adaptation. But in this case, they didn't do that. But they also weren't, like, they weren't taking lines from the book. It's obviously, it's a modern adaptation. It's set in America. Everything's changed. Yeah.
I agree.
Characters are, like, rewritten completely, I don't think successfully always, as we've said. Yeah, yes, 2 out of 10. Seen.
Okay, and I'll mirror that, because I could see the sort of bones of a Jane Austen novel under there, but yeah, didn't seem too exact from what I
barely
what
enough Austen for a broth.
Yeah, but yeah, it's like that stone broth where everyone says they're going to bring something and then all of them think, oh, I won't put my thing in because everyone else will put theirs in. And then, well, I'm taking the metaphor too far, but
that may have been on me. So that was our thoughts on From Prada to Nada. I do recommend watching it with a friend, maybe like a glass of wine or some hot chocolate and Netflix party. When you're feeling when you're feeling exhausted and a bit down,
a relaxing, feel good, slightly offbeat, romantic comedy.
Yeah. So for our next go, yes. Jess, I have. So some of our listeners may or may not know that I have a Twitch channel on which I have been reading Northanger Abbey at bedtime as
and
a bedtime
I have
story
deliberately
and you've deliberately
shunned
it. I have finished Northanger Abbey now and I'm going to be starting, and by the time this is released probably will already have started, a Jane Austen book club instead, which is, it's not going to be at bedtime because I get sleepy, but also the difference is that whereas previously I was just reading out the book, this time I'm going to be reading out the book and kind of explaining as I go for people who are completely new to Jane Austen. So this is basically, I guess, an extended plug of maybe you want to join that if you're listening to this.
Yeah, and to add to the appeal, I'm livid that I can't join that, because that sounds like something I would really enjoy if I didn't have to have my box fresh impressions of these films.
Your box first impressions, if you will. Ha 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 ha.
Ha ha! Oh, I'm doubled up with laughter.
So what I would really like to do is have a watching party for my Northanger Abbey crew, the ones that have, like, been watching me read Northanger Abbey, that most of them haven't read it before, and I would really like us all to sit and watch a Northanger Abbey adaptation. And ooh. I wondered if you might like to join us.
Absolutely.
Whether we might cover a Northanger Abbey adaptation.
Oh, sorry, were you asking, would you like to join us to me?
Yeah, I was asking, would you like to join us to you?
Or everyone. Oh, absolutely. And presumably it's a virtual watch party.
It is a virtual watch party, and I would love to invite the listeners to it. Unfortunately, because of scheduling these podcasts, I imagine that it will already have happened by the time that this is this is released.
You know what? I've done that really awkward thing where someone invites you to a party and then you just accidentally invite a load of other people that it might not even work for. And it's like, oh, there's like virtual faux pas.
Yeah. I'm really sorry, everybody who's listening to the podcast. I think this particular watching party will probably not be able to happen, but perhaps we can have another watching party another time. A good way to look out for any future watching parties would be to follow us on Twitter at Ostentations.
Yes, I might even dig out another amusing meme.
That would be delightful. Oh, and you know
what? I was so proud of sharing a meme. I've never shared a meme before.
I have seen you share upwards of one meme.
Oh, okay.
On your work account.
Oh, yeah, that was a terrible mishap.
I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
Those two facts may not be unrelated. I have now, for the first time ever, remembered to say that we have an email address.
Do we?
Yeah, we do. We actually have a Gmail address.
Fancy that.
And it is janeostentations@gmail.com. So if you have thoughts about the podcast, send them to us.
Yeah, costume trivia.
Oh my goodness, I've just logged into the podcast and we actually have one email. From a listener.
What? I feel like a famous person, like an actual celebrity.
That's so exciting. Oh, Lene says that they're listening from South Africa and there's not a lot of Jane Austen trivia there. So all of your historical snippets about costumes and settings, Jess, are great news, great new information. And it says that they hope when we get to the 1995 miniseries, we do a bumper or double episode on it because there's so much to discuss. And
I've heard of this much-hailed miniseries.
Yeah, I think that might well end up happening simply because I certainly don't think that I will be able to shut up about it.
I'll brace myself for that.
Yeah, then. So thank you so much for sending us that email. If you would like to do likewise, the email address is janeostentations@gmail.com. And you can get in touch with us at Twitter at Ostentations. And Jess, where can people find you and your stuff?
So my stuff, including absolutely varying levels of Regency costumery, can be at Jessica the Law, so Jessica THELAW.
Great, and you can find me at Sienna Sasha on Twitter. I'm very bad at other kinds of social media. I'm not amazing at Twitter either. I'm just slightly better at that than I am at the rest. So next time we will be watching a Northanger Abbey. However, we haven't quite discussed which Northanger Abbey we're going to be watching.
Okay.
So the choices are between.
Yeah.
The 2007, I believe, adaptation starring Felicity Jones and J.J. Field.
Right.
Or the 1984 adaptation starring Catherine Schlesinger and Peter Firth that, Jess, you have read a review of already.
Have I?
Yes, it was on my blog and it was...
Oh, I must have...
Roundly trashed.
Roundly trashed. I must have blocked that out. Well, I feel as if we have been watching fairly modern adaptations recently, and I would be interested to watch a more sort of retro adaptation. But if you've seen and reviewed that before and you'd find that boring, then I'd be happy to watch the 2007 one. Equally happy.
I don't think that I would find it boring. I do, however, think that the modern adaptation is probably a bit more accessible.
Okay, so let's go with it. Since it's a watch party,
let's go with that one. And then what we might do is make it a watch party next time that we do, when we do the 1984 one as well.
Yeah, because I've got really into, this is going to sound so specific, old-fashioned adaptations of even older-fashioned stories, where they put the fashions of the time like almost on top of the fashions of the era they're trying to portray. And you just end up with these horrifying mishmashes.
Yes.
So like I was watching Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand and it's set in the Edwardian era / 1920s. So you've got these 1920s flapper dresses, but then you've got full 1960s like makeup and hair. And it just creates this horrible mishmash, and it makes me think, like, what kind of mishmashes are we making nowadays that we don't even realise?
Well,
I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah, the 1984 one, I think, has definitely got that going on. And do you know what? I've actually just had Perhaps you just had an idea, which you may or may not be up for.
Oh, okay.
What about a double feature?
Double feature?
Yeah, what about we do a watching party where we watch the good one and then the bad one? And okay. I don't mean to give any... I'm giving too many impressions away. And
I don't know, there might be completely objective impressions.
Yeah. I feel quite confident that they will be widely shared.
Okay.
But how about we watch the newer one and then the older one? One after the other.
Am I allowed to go to the toilet in between?
No.
Oh, no! Well, I can't... Yeah, that's...
Yeah. And then we do, like, a bumper double feature watching party, and then we do one episode on one and the other episode on the other, and we can compare and contrast.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, we're introducing a new dynamic into the recipe.
Well, you've got to keep it fresh, you know? We've had three episodes, you know?
Yeah, people are going to be...
Podcasts
you know.
That run as long as ours need to shake it up a bit.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, I think that's a fantastic idea, and it's not like I've got anything better to do.
Cool. Well, we shall arrange that then.
Brilliant.
And it'll be very exciting.
Lovely.
Cool. So next time, we will be watching Northanger Abbey 2007 and Northanger Abbey 1984.
Wow.
Cool. Thank you so much for listening, everybody.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
And thank you for joining me, Jess. Bye.
Oh, pleasure.
Oh god, it's gone into Hips Don't Lie again.
It's so easy.
I can't help it.
Oh, should we just switch off record?
Yeah, let's.